Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Many people think Stoicism is merely a synonym for emotionless, or at most a dusty ancient Greek philosophy. Yes, Stoicism did originate with such ancient Illuminati as Seneca, Epictetus, and Marcus Aurelius, but Stoicism is far beyond just stay calm. And it's more widely used today than you might think. From the staff of the New England Patriots and the Seattle Seahawks, to broadcaster Michelle Tafoya, to rapper LJ Cool J. Not to mention past eminence from George Washington to Ralph Waldo Emerson. What is Stoicism really? And how might it be applied to our work lives? To help answer that question, my guest is Ryan Holiday. He is the author of a new book, The Daily Stoic, 366 Meditations on Wisdom, Perseverance, and the Art of Living. Ryan Holiday, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Well, the Stoics talk about a commitment to duty. It's kind of a word we don't hear very much these days. Well, in the workplace, that could be interpreted as a duty to work hard and honestly for the boss. But many people, especially here in the Bay Area, believe that capitalism is rigged against the worker. What would the Stoics say to such workers?
I don't exactly know. I think, obviously, as an ancient philosophy, it's somewhat distant from our sort of modern economic problems. But one of the most famous Stoics, actually the founder of Stoicism, Zeno, was a famous merchant. He actually discovered Stoic philosophy after a shipwreck of one of his caravans of goods had crashed. He said he suffered a shipwreck, but he discovered philosophy. So I think there's a connection between Stoicism and the marketplace and work and our obligations as human beings. I don't necessarily know what they would say about one's particular boss or whether their particular boss is exploitative or not. But I think Stoicism is very much aligned with the idea of sort of finding your life's task, whether that's being a politician or a programmer or a writer or a producer, finding that task and doing the work, doing your sort of role in society or life, whatever that might happen to be.
So implicit in that may be that your primary obligation is to not viscerally react to the boss who may be a jerk, mm-hmm. but to ask yourself, you as the old Hebrew National hot dog commercial, we appeal to a higher authority, or we hew to a higher authority. And the higher authority doesn't need to be a deity, but it's a cosmic obligation to make the most of your heartbeats, whether that's in a calm decision to say, screw the boss, or to say, I need this job, but I'm going to try to, work with it. Is it a matter of having a higher authority? Is that fair?
I think so. I'll give you two quick meditations from Marcus Aurelius,
great.
Who was at the time of his study of Roman Stoicism was the emperor of the greatest empire that had ever lived and mm-hmm. that had ever been. And there's this one meditation where he has this dialogue with himself where he's clearly struggling to get out of bed in the morning. He says, I want to stay under the covers and it's warm. And that he says to himself, but were you born to stay under the covers and be warm, or were you born with a job to do? So he's saying, we have these obligations as human beings. Some of our obligations are big, depending on where we fall sort of in society, and some of them are small, but we owe it to ourselves and to the world to do them well. And then there's another one where Marcus says to himself, never be overheard complaining at court, even to yourself. And so, here he is, he's the emperor of Rome, he's all powerful, he doesn't have to do any of this, and yet he's reminding himself that he does have to do it, that it is his obligation, and that he's going to do it cheerfully and not complain, not even privately.
When you hear the word complain, I hear, I guess we're all so suffused with the aftermath of the Trump election. Mm-hmm. Complain is, in some ways, a code for protest, and nobody's going to defend breaking windows. But, sir, would the Stoics have anything to say about the many angry people, especially here in the Bay Area, who are in shell shock
sure.
that Donald Trump won?
Look, I'd probably count myself among those people, but what the Stoics would ask us to look at is two things. One, they'd say, why were you surprised by this? You were surprised, they would say, because you had expectations, and those expectations are on you, right? That's the first thing they would say. And then they would say, what does complaining or being upset do in this situation? Because the answer is usually nothing. So they would urge you to be productive rather than to complain or to cast blame or to make this all about you.
So is productive necessary? You know, there are many, again, who say this is really a sign that the revolution is needed. You know, not just protest, but yes, your duty or whatever. You know, duty can be to be a good worker, be productive, be a great scientist, be a great manager, whatever. But some people feel a duty to foment the revolution. You know,
sure.
Capitalism stinks, and, you know, what would the Stoics say about revolution? Because there's a lot of anger. It's not just calm. Revolution is fueled by emotion. You know, even in the workplace, to unionize mm-hmm. is a radical action. It's saying, screw the boss. We are going to have collective action, and we want to overthrow the purely capitalist hegemony. What would the Stoics say about that?
I would probably venture to guess that the Stoics would mostly talk about they were big on acceptance, right? So I don't necessarily equate that with apathy, but I would say they'd probably be reluctant to throw around words like fomenting a revolution. But they are very big on acceptance and tolerance and making the best of every situation. So even let's say they were pro revolution, what they would be doing is making a distinction between talking and complaining about something and doing something.
Let's talk the tolerance thing in the workplace. Even, you know, mm-hmm. everybody in the workplace, or we call water cooler conversation, is about Donald Trump.
Yes.
And so would the Stoics say to quote, let's say somebody was a Trump voter, and there are, I just read in USA Today, 45% of college graduates voted for Donald Trump. They're not merely people with, you know, who are in Appalachia, you know, quote, ignorant. What? And so they're either quietly, they made these workers who are college graduates, let's just say, who are in the workplace and they're at the water cooler, and let's say they dare defy conventional wisdom and risk the opprobrium of saying why they felt that at this point in history, Donald Trump really is, that notwithstanding his personality, the right man at the right time.
Sure.
What would the Stoics say that the people who were very, very angry and frustrated about Donald Trump, what would they say that those Hillary supporters should say to Donald Trump, if anything?
Well, one of the things that you see from the Stoics talking that they talk about over and over again is, one, making the distinction between what you control and what you don't control. And the first thing you don't control is what other people say, think, or do. So I don't think they're going to be too concerned with why people think this and why they do that. And they're also going to be taking, and this is something I've had to remind myself in the aftermath of the election, is that although this particular result is disturbing and alarming and in some ways disgusting to me, in the larger historical view, it's utterly inconsequential, right? Marcus talks about this over and over again. He'll list all the emperors that came before him just a few generations before, and he'll go, nobody even remembers these people's names. He says if you would fly up in the air, you'd take Plato's view. He says the goings-on of human beings, even the Roman Empire, would look like a small colony of ants. So I think one of the things the Stoics would try to remind themselves of when they're feeling this anger and this rage and this disappointment is to say, hey, is this hitting me so hard because I'm making it such a big deal? I'm making it the center of my universe. I'm acting like it's the most important thing in the world, where even a terrible president like Nixon, we sort of remember partly with fondness, right? And if I could look 20 years in the future, how might I think about this thing that I'm so upset about right now? So it's about using logic and reason to sort of calm down some of our angry or upset impulses.
Yeah, of course, the visceral response is he's a racist, he's a homophobic, he's sexist, he's going to roll back the country. And yet I had a person who was telling me she was thinking about moving to Italy, not Canada, but to Italy.
Right.
And I said to her, I said, you know, I remember in my own lifetime when Eisenhower got elected, a military man, as a Republican military man, going to be the president of the United States, America's going to be doomed, and America survived. And then it was Nixon, and then it was Ronald Reagan, a B-grade actor or C-grade actor, Republican. The world's going to come to an end. And America, I guess, is more robust than that, so maybe that's useful.
And even if it is not robust, it does not necessarily follow that your life will be substantially turned upside down. You know, governments do occasionally fall. There are problems. Bad things happen. What the Stoics would say is, look, focusing on what may happen in the future is a way to make yourself miserable right now. And instead, you should focus on being resilient and obviously being prepared and obviously being sort of receptive to the fact that things may change or shift radically. But in the meantime, you have to be alive right now, and you can't let your obsession or your dread about the future take you away from that.
You know, it brings interesting that the talk about the past and talk about the future brings me to another. Many people in the workplace blame their problems on their childhood. I have a career counselor, and I cannot tell you how many clients say that their problems had their origins in their childhood. They had an abusive father, and they therefore see their boss as a microcosm of that. They were raped as a child, and so they're very, very fearful, or as a teenager, and they're very, very fearful in the workplace, etc. What would the Stoics say to the millions of people, frankly, the large majority who ended up in psychotherapy? What would the Stoics say to the many people who blame a lot of their current problems on childhood-rooted causes?
Well, I think one of the things the Stoics would say is there's a reason that Albert Ellis, when he creates cognitive behavioral mm-hmm. therapy, is relying so clearly on Stoicism, is this essential truth that, look, we don't control what happened to us or what happens to us. We control how we respond. We control what happens next. And so I think as human beings, we can get very caught up in our past and how it was unfair and how it shouldn't have happened, all of which we can sort of use as an excuse to take away our own agency over what we do with mm-hmm, that information. Mm-hmm.
I love that word agency. I think it's really right. And it started with the feminist movement, but I buy it completely. That many there are people on all variables, on height and weight or whatever, we're at kind of a normal distribution of bell curve. And that's the same true with agency. There are some people who feel or that they can, and some of that is just simply they're smart and they're healthy, so they feel they can control their world, but not everybody. But I think this notion of striving within not being delusional, mm-hmm. but trying to strive for maximum agency instead of playing external control. This is because of all things that happen to me as an individual and societal problems or whatever. You know, it's very easy to externalize.
I mean, look, and to make another political connection, Seneca is a Stoic in the time of Nero, right? He's actually assigned to be Nero's tutor. Like, imagine if you were picked by Donald Trump to be the tutor of one of his children, or to actually be his advisor, and you cannot say no. You know, this is obviously a heinous situation, and your job is to now sort of mitigate the excesses of this person you vehemently disagree with or find to be, perhaps a psychopath. So he's able to be a Stoic in one of the most dangerous times, political times in all of history. And so it's about eventually Nero forces Seneca to commit suicide. And Seneca faces this sort of death sentence with bravery, with courage, with compassion to the people around him. And it becomes sort of his defining moment. And I know that probably doesn't sound hopeful that, hey, this guy beautifully committed suicide, isn't that inspiring? But I think the point is, even in these dark, horrible moments, even in the absolute worst-case scenario, you look at someone like Viktor Frankl, who's sent to Auschwitz, you have some tiny bit of agency. Mm-hmm. You always determine your own thoughts about a situation. You always determine, within the responses allotted to you, you choose which one you are going to take. And I find that to be empowering.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Ryan Holiday. He's the author of the new book, The Daily Stoic, 366 Meditations on Wisdom, Perseverance, and the Art of Living. You talk about, that we do have some measure of agency, have some measure of control. And I remember a quote from your book, and it says, at the end of, this was Seneca, he said, at the end of each day, Seneca would ask himself, What bad habits did I curb today? How am I better? Were my actions just? How can I improve? And then you write, keep your own journal. Be unflinching in your assessments, end quote. Now, that runs counter to a core modern belief in the importance of self-acceptance. Today, study after study finds that most people consider themselves above average in everything from work performance to how well they drive a car. And I literally have had thousands of clients laid off and fired from their jobs. And most of them place most of the blame on other people, the boss, the dysfunctional organization, and yes, capitalism. And they are much less willing to look inward to do what Seneca urged. Do you have any thoughts on how to encourage people to look inward rather than externalize?
Well, I think first off, what Seneca is doing there is a fundamentally different kind of philosophy than how we think philosophy. You know, we think philosophy is the turtleneck university professor talking about, you know, the complicated questions of the universe, or, you know, even arcane, you know, ridiculous questions, theoretical questions, you know, are we living in a simulation, or, you know, is this ethical? Is that, the Stoics were about, you know, am I being a good person? Am I doing everything I can do? You know, what are my flaws? How can I fix them? How would I see myself objectively? So Seneca's writing this in a journal every single day. Marcus Aurelius' Meditation is actually that journal surviving to us. So I think, first off, they would, as you said, they would throw out this idea of radical self-acceptance, you know, the law of attraction, hey, if I just wish things are better, they'll become better, you know, or, you know, looking in the morning, looking in the mirror in the morning and saying, you're wonderful, you're amazing, everything you do is great.
Right.
They would instead be saying, look, I'm a human being, I have a lot of strengths, I also have weaknesses, you know, I'm going to strive to accentuate those strengths and reduce those weaknesses, not in the abstract, not hopefully, but I'm going to do it every single day and I'm going to work on it. And I am going to be unflinchingly honest with myself. I'm going to debrief, you know, at the end of the day. I'm going to brief myself at the beginning of the day on what I'm trying to accomplish. And I'm actually going to see if I did it. And I think that there's a reason that a number of the famous Stoics were very high performers who made, you know, their dent in the universe, so to speak, because they held themselves to these standards. They didn't just say, you're amazing, let things happen as they happen.
You know, I had never really thought of, and it was obvious that people have journals ever since papyrus, but I hadn't thought about the fact that that people did, and that eminence like Seneca did journal. It's something I recommend to all my clients, and dear listeners, I want to speak now directly to you for just a moment. There are hidden values in journaling that we may not think about. When you're getting advice from somebody else, there's a natural tendency to reject it because it denies your agency. It makes you feel out of control. And usually the advice giver doesn't know you as well as you know yourself. Well, for those two reasons are countered by journaling. You know yourself better than most other people do. And you're not going to get defensive because you're giving yourself advice. I do encourage you to journal. And one of my favorite techniques for journaling is to go point counterpoint. Make all the arguments, for example, why you should quit your job. Then become your alter ego or the opposing attorney and make all the arguments for why you should stay. And keep going back and forth and back and forth until some measure of clarity accrues. What's your reaction to that, Ryan?
Yeah, I think that is right. I mean, it's fascinating to me that Stoic philosophy, as we get it from Marcus Aurelius, is essentially the jottings and musings of not only an incredibly powerful man, but a man who had absolute power. You know, we have this idea that absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Right.
And yet, here you have the journal of someone struggling against that very thing. He called it imperialization. He's trying to struggle against the robe of the emperor staining him with the imperial markings, the way that it had corrupted other individuals. So to me, it's an incredibly powerful statement about what journaling can do for someone, that it managed to keep sane a person who was essentially being worshipped as a god in his own lifetime. Hopefully we don't have that level of responsibility or stress on us, and hopefully it can make, you know, a difference in its own way for us.
I think, Ryan, I think you should write a letter to President-elect Trump and encourage him to journal. What do you think?
I would love to see that journal purely as a psychological artifact.
It would be a bestseller in a moment. Right. Unfortunately, it might be very brief. It says, I am king. I am. No, I'm sorry. I should not be doing that. I'm not supposed to be political. And it's not like I'm some wild leftist. I'm not. But sure. I'm worried about him.
Well, anyway. I mean, look, I wrote a book on ego
last year.
And I think one of the interesting things that I got from one of Trump's comments, you know, someone asked, who advises you? And he says, oh, I advise myself.
I know.
I have a
bad,
very big brain.
Bad, bad, bad.
You know, that's the opposite of Stoicism. Stoicism was about attaching yourself to a great master. It was about, you know, gauging your behavior against the Stoic sages of the past who had lived great lives. It's about looking at where you need to improve. It's about sort of diminishing that sort of toxic sense of self. And so I think, you know, Plato talked about the idea of the philosopher king. I would argue that, you know, Trump is the antithesis of that, sadly. And it is somewhat alarming.
And, you know, in a way, this seems like an odd link, but this has to do with crowdsourcing. Mm-hmm. Everybody knows that the information that exists in most Wikipedia entries, because they are crowdsourced, represents more wisdom than was in the Encyclopedia Britannica, where they had some dusty scholar write what he or she thought. And
absolutely.
And it's the same thing. I mean, I was not a big Obama fan. I got real concerns about some of his policies, but he really surrounded himself by the smartest minds. Yes, mainly leftists, but really smart minds, and he was not an autocrat. While, yes, he made executive orders, which I oppose that he did so much, that is too much like a king, but he was more of a listener than damn Donald Trump, and that scares the hell out of me.
Well, and I guess the other point, and this is where I think Trump is quintessentially anti-Stoic, is the sort of temperament that Obama managed to hold in office.
And Hillary.
You know, yes, you know, accused of horrible things, you know, sort of stressed and challenged and tried in various different ways, and his ability to remain a sort of dispassionate and calm.
Yep.
It strikes me as strange and historically anomalous that one of the things that we think our foreign policy needs today is not Obama's dispassion, but we actually need more saber rattling and anger and ego, and we need someone to go out there and just sort of say crazy things just to let the world know who we are. You know, the Stoics would be very much in the Roosevelt school of speak softly but carry a big stick.
You know, I want to interrupt. I don't want to get into the politics so much, but this has tremendous relevance to you in your workplace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is a balance between you want to have a measure of agency, as we talked earlier, and yet not hubris, which is a word that comes from the ancient Greeks, excess confidence, and it is, there's just too much information to think that you have all the answers. So, yes, have agency, but the wise man and woman, whether you're a clerk or you're a CEO, has really smart and wise advisors from the full range of perspectives, not just the Bay Area echo chamber, but there is wisdom that resides right of center. You live in Austin, Texas, so you've got some conservatives. Not all Texans are yokel idiots. There are some very intelligent conservatives, and the wise leader, and I wish it were Donald Trump, but it could be you in your workplace. Don't just look for yes men and yes women. Look for intelligent, benevolently derived thoughts from the full range of perspectives. Is that a fair statement that's what reflects Stoicism?
I would say absolutely. And it's not just about your advisors, but also your hunger to learn
and
expose yourself to information.
Yes.
There's a line from Epictetus, one of the Stoics, and he says, one cannot learn that which they think they already know.
Yes.
So if you think you know everything there is to know, if your mind has closed itself off to new ways of thinking, that is going to hold you back, and that is going to cause a number of problems.
Exactly. I just gave a talk yesterday at the Mensa convention, and I was sitting in the hospitality room with a bunch of people, and I was really impressed with even those, you know, who were extremely unhappy. They would have attended a cry-in for the Trump win.
Mm-hmm.
They were good at really asking questions to unearth other perspectives, because Mensa, because it's an elitist organization, does tend to get some intelligent conservatives. And it was really inspiring to see that. And that, I think, is something in the workplace, whether we're talking politics or we're talking about who to promote or how to streamline a process or how we can be environmentally responsible. Listening not just to the left that's always going to want to be, say, quote, environmentally responsible, but the right that might say, is this cost effective? What are the liabilities associated with this? Where is the greatest net good? That's the kind of measuredness that Obama and Hillary had that Trump does not, apart from their politics, which actually brings me to this point. I'm really, really interested in this. You know, the idea of certainly, of stoicism is staying calm amid the maelstrom. Now, it's not just by choice that President Obama and Hillary are calm. I profoundly believe that they, I'm being a little metaphorical here, have smaller adrenal glands. I am just intense and hyper by nature. I intellectually understand and respect calm. What advice do you have? What advice would the Stoics have for somebody who physiologically goes from 0 to 60 in 2 seconds?
Sure, and I sort of put myself in that camp because I don't think I'm a naturally calm person. Most people describe me as intense. So I think stoicism is something that I've had to work on and think a lot about and practice, you know, stoicism as a practice in the way that meditation is a practice. And that's different than a lot of philosophy. You know, stoicism isn't something you learn one time and then magically you have it. So I would actually, one of my theories, and, you know, not being an academic, I can't necessarily prove this, but I think Marcus Aurelius and the other Stoics are writing about these things and practicing them precisely because they struggle with them. They're not writing, hey, make sure you should laugh when things are funny. They're not saying, hey, sex feels good, don't forget that. You know, they're reminding themselves, they're working on it because it is not natural to be calm in a stressful situation. I would argue that Obama and Hillary, they've had to work for it. When that fly lands on her face in a debate, she didn't freak out because she had practiced and she'd thought about what kind of demeanor do I want to have during this debate?
Let me be personal. Let me ask you, you know, since you, like me, are not naturally calm, and by the way, I will disagree a little bit. I think that some of it is physiological. I know that there are some people, you know, you have 10 people in a room, and if there's a loud bell that suddenly goes off, some people will jump faster than others.
Sure.
That's physiological. And I think that both Obama and Hillary have the gift of calm. But I'm interested in you because you're not naturally so. What has worked, honestly, and you could say nothing.
What, if anything, has
worked to help you who's not naturally calm under stress? What's worked for you?
I'll give you a big one. You know, you mentioned that I live in Austin. I don't have to live in Austin. I've lived in Los Angeles. I've lived in New York City. I've lived in other cities. I tended to find that when I'm around a lot of sort of bustle and energy, I pick that up. So I felt like in New York, my sort of traits that I was wishing to work on were exacerbated. They were constantly triggered. And I needed to find a different environment that allowed me to work on and catch some of those
Love
things. It. If I felt like the world was going a million miles around me, I would.
Love
so
it.
I think environmental factors are a big part.
Love it. And I frankly have done the same thing. I work for myself. I work from home. No commute because I'd get annoyed if I had to be sitting in traffic all the time. If I was in a bustling office, I'd be very worried I wasn't doing a good enough job, or I'd be terribly worried about my boss. Being self-employed, working at home has been relatively helpful to me. I want to give my listeners a chance to ask you a question or two. Dear listeners, if you've been listening to this, I'm talking with my guest, Ryan Holiday. He is the author of The Daily Stoic, 366 Meditations on Wisdom, Perseverance, and the Art of Living. If you've listened to this and you have a question or a comment for Ryan Holiday about your own attempts to be stoic, or whether you think this is all full of it and you think it's, you know, you have a different perspective, all perspectives, as long as they are benevolently derived, are welcome here at Work with Marty Nemco. You don't even need to be stoic about it. The phone number here, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Now, the Stoics say that the right thing to do always comes from, quote, our reasoned choice. Not whether something is rewarded, not whether something will succeed, but whether it's the, quote, right choice. It's what we've been talking about. Don't get upset. Do the right thing. That's it. But what if living your values has already devastated your personal and professional life? For example, I have a client who is very against affirmative action. She believes that in the real world, it turns out to be reverse discrimination, which is net bad for the workplace and for society, and that has gotten her fired twice. She's also come to the conclusion at this point in history that voting for Donald Trump was net best for humankind. She has lost a number of her friends for saying that. Would the Stoics tell her to continue doing what she believes is her reasoned choice?
Well, first off, I think that the reasoned choice is not necessarily reasonable choices. It's the focus on yourself and your own decisions and your own choices, not on other people. So, okay, I personally think affirmative action is, you know, I'm not talking about myself. I'm saying hypothetically someone thinks something about affirmative action. That's great. The idea that you need to go around in your workplace bothering other people about this thing, that is, you would call anti-Stoic. That is why it's causing problems for her. Everyone is free to vote for who they choose. Fine. But it's the idea that you need to force these decisions or force them on other people where it starts to become problematic. So the misery then that Trump didn't get elected for a Democrat, or the exuberance that Trump did get elected on the conservative, these are both beyond your reasoned choice. These are beyond your control. This is focusing yourself on other people, and I think that's where the Stoics are telling you to in effect, to rein it in, to focus on yourself.
But here I've got to push back. Then that doesn't lead to excessive selfishness and also then no change. For example, she believed that the world would be better. The company, the employees, the customers, society, if she felt that race was not taken into consideration in the hiring process. That was her professional judgment, and she was part of a team that was making decisions. She was on hiring committees in a number of times. And she would fight back against what she thought was a, quote, reverse discrimination hire in favor of a more competent person. And if she kept it in, then isn't she accepting a value that she really believes is wrong? And let's take it from a liberal perspective. Let's say she was somebody who is very in favor of having more minorities to have America look more like the workplace, and the workplace look more like America, et cetera, et cetera. And would the Stoics tell her to shut up?
No, I don't think they would. I think they would say, look, you are doing the right thing, and that right thing comes with a cost, right? Society does not always accept the right thing. Society often judges people who make these decisions. And if one is going to pursue doing what they believe is the right thing, they also have to be, content with or acknowledge that there may be consequences for that decision.
That's pretty tough. Yeah.
And that's part of life.
Pretty tough. Well, saying, yeah, right. And it was very hard. She, when she got fired a second time, she knew she'd have a hell of a time getting hired. It's a big price to be true to your values, especially if they run counter to the dominant culture. It's really easy for us in this lovely little chair, we're both well-employed, for us to say, yes, follow your dream, you'll pay a price. But when you end up being unemployable or you lose your friends, as is in this woman's case, Seneca, died for his beliefs, so did Socrates. So have many soldiers have died by the thousands for their beliefs. Anyway, let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco with my guest Ryan Holiday, the author of The Daily Stoic. What is your question or comment for him? Hello.
Are you there?
I am.
Yeah.
Hello.
So, Michael is my name.
Michael, it sounds like you've got your radio on. Could you turn it down, please? Or maybe you're talking too close into the receiver.
I'm on Bluetooth.
I see. Okay, make it quick.
So, as a Stoic, how do you present facts to people? And essentially, like this woman you were just talking about, you have to change her mind about these things. And you present facts, and it still doesn't work.
What do you think, Ryan?
Well, I guess I would ask why is it on you to change other people's minds? I tend to say that we can get very concerned and caught up with forcing other people to believe what we believe or needing them to agree with us. We have so much in our own lives that we need to focus on. So I think the Stoic would first and foremost be a bit more indifferent to the need to convince people of these things than than you or I might instinctually be.
And Michael, I would probably do it, I'd say a little bit, just a little bit differently, which is, you know, is it just possible, because we do live in an echo chamber here in the Bay Area, is it just possible, instead of saying that your goal is to convince her, that your goal is to be a statesman, and that is to try to understand her perspective. As I said, 45% of all college graduates voted for Trump. They're not all, you know, retardates. So is it possible that you need to express your thoughts as thoughtfully as you can, ideally with a question which actively engages her, and then you need to afford him or her the same thing back and try to really understand? Because real power, real agency comes from understanding the full range of perspectives, not from, I'm going to try to convince that stupid Trump voter. Is that a fair statement on my part, in your judgment?
Yeah, I believe it is about them changing their own minds, not you changing their minds.
But what about you changing your, I mean, you know, it is a little hubristic that we have a monopoly on intelligence. That because we voted for Hillary, we are intrinsically smarter, and our job is either to, you know, let them come to their own change of mind. I worry about us being so darn cocksure of ourselves, which is what,
right.
You know, is that
right, and I agree with you. I agree with you, but there's a good bit of people out there that are about, I'm going to change this person's mind.
Yes.
Where it is a mindset. They have to change their own mind. So how do we become better statesmen or leaders or models that somebody might see us and go, hey, what's that all about, and change their own mind.
Love, sure. Through questions. Yeah, right. My big thing is questions. What do you add one more thing, and then we'll get another call. What do you think, Ryan?
Well, I would say, you know, the Stoics are obviously very big about leading by example, and I think that goes to the caller's point.
Yep, exactly.
Instead of trying to convince people's minds, why don't you get your own life in order? Why don't you line the facts up as you see them and leave them there for that person to take them as they will, instead of feeling like it's your obligation to force them to accept what you think or believe.
Yeah, that one more point that I really agree with that. You know, it's like every parent knows that lecturing your kid is going to have far less likelihood of changing the kid than modeling good behavior. If the parent lectures the kid about not smoking pot and they're drinking their butts off, you know, it's going to be hard for the lecture to work. You judge by we change people more by example. So, anyway, thank you very much for the call. I want to take one more call, at least maybe two. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemcom. I guess Ryan Holiday, the author of The Daily Stoic. What's your question or comment for him?
This is my question. How does one go about finding a Stoic mentor?
Ooh, Ryan.
That is a great question.
It is.
Well, the nice part is, obviously, we have, you know, 2,000 years of Stoic philosophy. Very well-documented individuals from Seneca, Marcus Aurelius, Epictetus, even more recently someone like James Stockdale. They've all written books. They've all published their thinking. You know, the Stoics loved biography as a way of learning. Mm. You know, one of the other famous Stoics is Cato. Cato never wrote anything down, to go to our last point. He was considered a Stoic philosopher from how he lived his life. His example worked for the other Stoics. And Seneca says this. He says, find yourself a Cato. You know, find someone whose behavior and lifestyle and approach you admire, and use that as a ruler to guide your own behavior and thinking about. He also says, which I love, he says, you know, we can't choose our parents, but we can choose whose children we would like to be. But that means he can choose what tradition we want to hail from, who we want to emulate, who we want to go to for advice. So I think, first, I would guide you towards the ancient models, the ancient Stoics as mentors, and then I would urge you to find people who seem to be living good lives, who seem to be doing and responding to things in ways that you would like to respond and attach yourself to them.
I'd like to add two other things. I think the more I've been involved in as a quote change agent my whole life, the more I believe in keeping things simple. And one of the reasons I love his book, The Daily Stoic, is in one short page for each day, he offers some practical advice. I would urge you, and I don't do this for all the people who write books on who come on my show. I would encourage you to buy a copy of The Daily Stoic. And every day, perform a ritual. And as you get up in the morning, read and take 30 seconds to deep breathe and meditate on its message. because it's called 366 Meditations. It's only going to take you about 1 minute to read and 30 seconds to meditate on it. And that will be maybe the cheapest and the best mentor you could ever have around Stoicism. But now the second thing I do is I want to ask you a question. Normally when people ask a question like that, there is a problem that they're facing that they wish they were more, quote, Stoic about. Is there a problem, and I'd be happy with Ryan, you know, along with Ryan here, to help you with the specific issue that you're facing. What is an issue you're facing in your life that you would like to be to find maybe some answers from Stoicism?
I would like to follow the philosophy. I would like to be able to accept things as they are and change my attitude.
What's one thing? What is one thing you want to... Ideally, it would be in the workplace, because we focus here on the show on the work. What would be one thing that you would like to accept with greater grace?
I'm no longer working, and I'm at a point in my life where I want to change my personality a little bit.
What is it? What if you could? If I could wave a magic wand within reality, I mean, you know, you're not going to play basketball for the Golden State Warriors, but within the realm of personality change that's realistic, if we waved a magic wand, what would your personality look like that is different from what it is now?
I would like that when I'm annoyed, I still act kindly.
Okay. Ryan, what do you have to... let's say she's annoyed at somebody, a coworker or a romantic partner or Donald Trump or whatever. She's annoyed. What have we not discussed that you might want to suggest to her that the Stoics would have to say to her?
Well, I think, I'm probably sounding like a broken record. The Stoics would say to focus on yourself and to leave other people to their own lives and their own problems and to focus instead on what you can do better, whether that's throwing yourself into some form of self-improvement, some form of study, some part of your relationship that you want to get better. So I'd say that's where I tend to start. In my book about ego, I got so many questions. People go, how do I deal with my boss's ego? You know, my boss has his ego out of control. And I'd say the answer is leave your boss alone and focus on where you act egotistically, and I imagine you will see a much more immediate improvement in your situation than if you're trying to focus on other people.
Dear caller, I've learned that major characterological change is best like a salami eaten a bite at a time. So let's take one example. Who is somebody? Well, give me an actual example of when you were annoyed at somebody and that you were not able to stay calm, but you would like to be able to. Tell me an example.
Well, probably when road rage, if somebody flips me off or cuts me off, it makes me mad. I don't do anything about it, but I wish it didn't make me mad.
Great. So let's trust, I have a phrase I like to use, which is the goddess within you. All of us has a jerk within us and a goddess or god within us. So what would the wise woman within you say? Or your wiser twin sister, let's do it that way. Let's say you had a wiser twin sister, and she was sitting next to you in the passenger seat in the car, and somebody just cut you off. What would your wiser twin sister tell you to do so that you don't get annoyed at that driver?
She would say, let it go.
Why? And why? What's the reason to let it go? That's the behavior outcome. Why should you let it go?
Because it was his behavior, not your behavior.
Good. Keep talking. What else? Why else should you let it go?
Because that's one of the principles I want to live by.
Why?
I don't want to let external events affect me when I have nothing. There's nothing I can do about them.
Sounds great. Ryan, you have anything?
One of the things I found yesterday, I was on the phone with my cell phone company. There was some problem with my phone, and I ended up getting very angry. I slapped the table a few times in frustration, like very loudly, and it's something I'm trying not to do anymore. And as I sort of caught myself having done it, I stepped back and I looked at the way in which my anger and frustration in this situation had been ratcheted up. And that if I was stepping outside myself, I could have almost predicted that this was the inevitable outcome. This is also part of cognitive behavioral therapy, sort of noticing the patterns or the loops that our behavior is going. So instead of just saying, how can I not do that thing anymore, why don't we go, okay, what are some of the intermediate steps between this and this other thing I don't like, and let's stop there. So maybe I should have gotten off the phone earlier, I should have taken a deep breath, I should have, you know, said, hey, this might happen. Why don't you commit to yourself? You're not going to do it. You know, I could have handed the phone to someone else and asked them to do it for me. You know, there's a number of intermediate steps that I could have taken that would have prevented this outcome rather than simply saying, I don't want to do this anymore.
One other thing is rehearsal. Children know they're scared, for example, of being in a fire, so they play fire. They're scared of going to the doctor, so they play doctor. So if you know, as one example of something that could annoy you, a driver cutting you off, anticipate when you get in the car and say, you know what, some driver is probably going to cut me off or do something stupid or drive in the left lane. He's driving way too slow. He's probably stoned or drunk. And, you know, rehearsing in advance what your wiser twin sister would say so that you're not having to respond in the moment, but you've got some planful stuff. Does that make any sense?
It makes a lot of sense. I really appreciate it.
And I appreciate your call very much. I'm finding this useful. The calls are good. Let's take another call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. Ryan Holiday, the author of The Daily Stoic, which is really a series of 1 minute activities every day. 1 minute to read and then 30 seconds to meditate on some thoughts that can really help us in really forgetting about Donald Trump. These are stressful times. I was just reading a bunch of statistics about employment and let me read you some of this before we go to the phones. Nearly 7 out of every 10 Americans have less than $1,000 in savings. That means two-thirds of the country is living paycheck to paycheck. Reuters is reporting that U.S. mall investors are poised to lose billions of dollars because people can't spend anymore. The rate of home ownership has fallen for 8 years in a row, now hovering near a 50-year low. The total number of government employees now outnumbers the total number of manufacturing employees in the U.S. by almost 10 million. The number of homeless people in New York, where Donald Trump is from, has hit a brand new record high. 20% of young adults are currently living with their parents. Total household debt in the U.S. has now reached $12.3 trillion. And U.S. debt is now approaching $20 trillion. It isn't easy. If we need to be able to somehow have some perspective, or we're going to go nuts. Ryan, any comments before we go right back to the phones?
Yeah, I think understanding the reality of other people's situations and the needs that they're in is important. I would also say the Stoics would probably, you know, it's always about counterpoint. And part of it would be to say, hey, things can look really dire and this can be alarming and I should be stressed. And they would also say, you know, arguably this is the greatest time in the history of the world to be alive.
Right.
You know, these are the opportunities that I've been afforded. I didn't choose to have these benefits or these potential disadvantages, but I am going to choose what I'm going to do with my life and with my situation.
Let's take one more call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest, Ryan Holiday, and he's the author of The Daily Stoic. What is your question or comment for him?
Hi, Marty. Is this me?
Yes, it is.
Great. I have a question. I'm actually seeking advice for another friend. She's currently on a performance improvement program, and she's not confident that she's going to be able to pass it.
Right.
And so the question that I have for you is it more advantageous for her to quit before the end of that performance improvement program, or should she go ahead and get fired? Now, the caveat to that is the company has communicated to her that if she were to get fired, they would not contest unemployment. So that's what's, I guess, you know, holding her back from just quitting right away. So I just wanted to get your perspective. Also, there's, you know, just in terms of being employable again, I'd imagine it looks terrible to have been fired from a job.
Of course.
So that's what she's grappling.
Well, the standard methodology is you wait to get fired, start putting her feelers out now, because it takes months and months to get hired. She's currently still hired, so by doing her outreach now, she can claim that she's still employed. But when at the time of firing, she or, you know, quote, being laid off or whatever, she can she will be then not only get unemployment, but part of the negotiation. Everybody's, and you say she's a woman. 50% of women and minorities file wrongful termination suits at the end of suits, and so companies and even government agencies and nonprofits are very afraid. So she actually has some negotiating power. I don't think it's ethical, but it's, you know, if it's legitimate, but she, you know, threatens the suit, and then they actually do. They agree to not give bad reference, and they give her a severance package. So standard practice, she starts putting out her feelers now while she's employed. She doesn't quit. And then when they fire her, she does, or let her off, they'd have to, quote, lay her off so that she can get unemployment, because if she's fired for cause, she can't. And then try to negotiate some kind of agreement where they don't say what a horrible worker she was. That's the pragmatic answer. I don't know about the ethical one.
I would also ask, you know, what does one learn by quitting?
Right.
And you know, we talked a lot about agency. Who is to say that she can't pull herself out of the situation and that, you know, it couldn't be addressed? So that would be something to think about as well.
It's a good point. 75% of the time, they put you on an improvement plan mainly because it's legally required and they really want to dump you no matter what.
Sure.
But 25% of the time, it's absolutely true. So if she feels that this could be a wake-up call, Ryan, I was really glad you mentioned that. If you feel it was a wake-up, if she feels it was a wake-up call and that there was some, you know, again, most people, they don't just lay off at random. They don't fire her. She must be doing some, maybe, unless the boss is some Nazi horrible person. But generally, when they put people on an improvement plan, it's a pain in the butt. It's time-consuming. She's probably done some stuff that's bad. If she feels it's remediable, for her to use that as a wake-up call and say, you know what, I've been whatever, too lazy, not technical enough, whatever the hell it is, if she says, I'm going to be really great and I'm going to keep reporting to my boss all the progress so that he or she sees that I am really making, and I am improving as a result of the plan, I think Ryan's point is excellent, along with what I said. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Ryan, I want to say goodbye to you, but I want to give you one last softball question.
Okay.
Every single guest who's ever appeared on the show in his 27 years has always gotten off and said, oh, geez, I wish I had said that. So I'm simply going to ask you, what is the one more thing you want to tell our listeners? It could be about stoicism or not. You've written a bunch of books. You're a smart guy, interesting guy, fair-minded guy. What's the one thing you want to tell my work-oriented audience? The show's about career. What's one thing you haven't said that you'd like to tell my listeners?
That is a great question. I think one of the things that I love about Stoicism is that it is this sort of tried and true formula that has existed through some of the most turbulent times in all of history, and it's still with us. And, you know, there's this great line from Bismarck where he says, you know, any fool can learn by experience. I prefer to learn from the experience of others. So I would urge people to avail themselves of this tradition. You don't have to read my books. The ancient sources are wonderful and eminently readable. Why aren't you taking advantage of these thousands of years of wisdom and advice and improving your life as a result of them?
This kind, modest person is one of the few guests who've ever said, don't read my book. Read his book. I swear on my mother's life, she's dead, but on my mother's honor, that the book, The Daily Stoic, 366 Meditations on Wisdom, Perseverance, and the Art of Living, is worth, I read it cover to cover slowly. I actually savored it before having him on the show, before deciding to have him on the show. So I do commend it to you. And I commend Ryan Holiday. Thank you very much for giving me part of your Sunday on Work with Marty Nemco.
Thanks so much.
Take care. Bye. We've got a few minutes left. I want to help you individually. It's, you know, I'm always nervous about abstractions. So I'm interested in you. If you've got a work-related problem that you're finding it tough to be stoic about, whether you're unemployed or well-employed and still unhappy, self-employed, nonprofit employed, government employed, corporate employed, self-employed entrepreneur, if you got a work problem, I can usually help. The phone number here, Work with Marty Nemco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. While I'm waiting for the calls to come in, this is the time of year people are deciding. Normally, the University of California deadline is November 30th. We're really coming close to that. As you know, if you're a regular listener to the show, you know I have deep reservations about higher education being worth the time and money in an era where so many people are getting degrees, it's no longer the differentiating factor. Yes, many employers will only hire somebody who's got a degree, but not all. And one has to look at the cost effectiveness, not just the money, but the time that's involved in going back to school. So I do urge you to think about whether we know there's some advantage to getting the degree. I understand a piece of paper is going to help you a lot, but really ask yourself if that is the optimal use of your time. Could you not do your learning on a just-in-time basis through Udemy courses, through mentorships, through self-study, through internships? Doing your learning on a just-in-time basis is often great, and especially if you keep a journal of your ongoing learning, and then submit that journal, an edited version of that journal with your applications. Sure, big corporations are generally not going to touch you because they have rigid rules. Government tends to be pretty rigid about education requirements. But a more thoughtful employer will see that you did a lot of this really just-in-time practical learning, and you may in fact find it, not only did you save a fortune, but you learned more of relevance. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It is your turn on the air. How can I help you? Hi, it's you.
Hi. When does a Stoic know to become an activist?
Great question.
For example, at work, if you see someone engaging in, let's say, bullying or sexual harassment, not to you, when do you take action? And on a larger level, politically, when do you know when to demonstrate, when to sit in?
Love it. I am, at my core, I am a statistician. I am a probabilist. So I am asking myself, what is the probability of a given action yielding enough benefit to compensate for the time, stress, and possible negative consequences? So you talk about a bully in the workplace. I will make an assessment whether that person is likely to be open to the kind of input that I could provide. For example, I am just, by nature, I'm a hothead. I'm the least able to persuade somebody to come to my position, even though I'm very rational, not stupid, but I'm a hothead. I'm intense. So I don't try to be a change agent around politics or things like that, because I know that for me, all I'm going to do is generate hot air and annoy people. So asking yourself, given your personality and the personality of the, quote, bully, how likely is it that you will be able to affect enough change in him to result to justify the stress and the time? Similarly, from a macro point of view, this is a personal statement rather than something everybody should do. In my judgment, while yes, collective action and protesting or whatever serves some net benefit, I'm always asking, is this the best use of my heartbeats? When there are 1,000 people in downtown Oakland breaking windows and, you know, and they're beaten up and whatever, and is that, how likely is my presence to make enough of a difference to make that the best use of my time? I would rather, if I was an activist and let's say, whatever, in my workplace or macro, I would use my best skills to make the biggest difference I can. I like to think of myself as a writer. I do very badly in verbal attempts at persuasion, but I'm not so bad at writing. So my way would be to write. There, I'm saying the time and the effort and the risks are smaller, except in certain areas. If I'm politically incorrect, the risks are too great. So I have shut up about most of my politically incorrect views, because you don't change anybody's mind, you just get in trouble. But where my views are at least not going to get me bashed or fired, I will move to right. So I'm asking you, in the case of the bully, and in the case of when you say protest, I'm assuming you mean the Trump election, what does your calculus say, given your strengths and weaknesses, say you should do about the bully? And what should you do, say, about, say, political activism?
Well, for me personally, what I would do is try to organize others who are of like mind in the workplace.
Okay.
And as together, as a collective,
Love it.
And rather, because, you know, frankly, taking an individual action, especially against a superior or even a superior superior, you might as well quit.
Agree with you completely.
But on a larger level, I kind of disagree, because this, by going along, to get along, so you get along by going along, things like class actions don't help. And protests do make a difference.
They do, but not the individual.
Not right away.
In the interest of time, because I got to stop. And yes, collectively they do. But the issue is, we have a certain number of heartbeats. And asking yourself whether your time and effort and risk to your body and limb is going to generate enough of a difference. If you believe in the collective action thing, fine. You can do that on a macro level too. Form an organizing caucus. You know, lobby for, you know, work on campaigns for candidates you believe in, for, you know, Bernie Sanders type or whatever, or run for office yourself. But being one of 1,000, you're a grain of sand on a beach. So from a utilitarian perspective, I'm nervous, and I have to end it there because we are out of time. So I take 10 seconds to respond briefly on that, on my thought there.
Well, that's fine, but let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Did the protests in the late 60s and 70s help to end the war?
Enormously, of course, but I'm talking about what is the incremental choice of an individual? I know we can't generally say, if everybody did that, there'd be no protest. I got it. But I think it's wise to be thinking about the likelihood of your individual action making a difference. Anyway, now I have to say goodbye, but I really appreciate your call very much. Thanks for calling Work with Marty Nemkov.
You're welcome.
And that is the show for this week. I want to thank my border operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I'll do workovers on callers, and I will perform excerpts from some of America's most influential speeches, and I'll highlight the rhetorical devices that they use that you can use to improve your work life and your life outside of work. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemkov reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.
to martynemko.com for the archive of his articles and information on his 8 books, including his latest, The Best of Marty Nemko. That's martynemko.com. Join him next Sunday morning at 11 for Work with Marty Nemko on 91.7 KALW San Francisco.
Later today on This American Life.
You're not going to go drink that soda in there, are you?
Yes, I am.
No.
What
the soda is ancient. And the fridge is filled with roaches.
The fridge is not filled with roaches.
Why don't you take a look and see what's in here?
In his mid-30s, Josh moved back home to take care of his alcoholic mom.
Dead roaches everywhere.
Well, they're dead. They can't hurt me anymore.
Later today.
1 o'clock this afternoon, just an hour from now, on KALW San Francisco.
Here it is!
From deep inside your audio device of choice.
Ladies and gentlemen, I do need luck just to say ladies and gentlemen. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a week notable for the passing of some notable people in public life in America. A newswoman, back when I admired news people, I admired Gwen Ifill more than most, the formidable soul sister, Sharon Jones, and two piano men who, in their very different ways, injected just a little more of the darkly magical brew of the South into American music. Leon Russell and Mose Allison will be playing some of their music today. On my way here to